And the theme for tonight is Christian discipleship in a nuclear age. And several people have asked, and I thought it would be appropriate to set the stage for our discussion, if Robert and Janice, who are down now only to one of their copies, could sit next to each other and do their bow and arrow thing for us, and then we can launch off into a discussion wherever we want to go with the discussion this evening.
I've got an arrow. Anyone who threatens me will get stuck with it.
It's not fair. I need her an arrow so that she wouldn't stick hers in me, because then I'll stick my arrow into her.
Now I've got a bow. I can shoot my arrow at him, and he can't reach me with his. I'm his boss again.
Now we're equal again. I made a bow, same as her.
I've made two more bows and three arrows. I can shoot him four times if he tries to shoot at me.
I stayed up all night and got my family to make arrows. I have 5 bows and 10 arrows, so I can kill her 10 times if she shoots at me. I'm boss now.
I made a special speedy arrow which goes twice as fast as his arrow. If I see him shooting at me, I can shoot him before his arrow hits me.
I have made a stronger bow which can fire 3 arrows at one time, so I can hit her 3 times in one place while she's shooting at me.
Maybe I should shoot him first before he makes a stronger bow, in case he thinks of shooting me. This way I can hit him once before he can fire 3 arrows at me. Or maybe we should have some talk and stop making bows and arrows. Hey, you, what about stopping making bows and arrows?
Oh, no. You have more arrows and a stronger bow than me. So wait until I can make 2 more arrows and a stronger bow, then we'll talk. Oops. Sorry, my finger slipped. Don't shoot it with a wee mistake. Sorry. Oh, butter fingers.
Somewhat humorous, but somewhat serious. So goes sense and nonsense, I guess. Open forum, what would you like to discuss in the whole broad area of Christian discipleship in a nuclear age? What's on your mind? Don't worry, we will get going. We just have to wait a while as we form our thoughts. This one has never failed us yet. I think that's one of my problems. I don't know about the rest of you, but it's definitely one of my problems. Yes. You were going to say?
Well, I guess in Alberta we're hearing a lot about the cruise missile these days. It's the big issue there because that's where they want to test them. One thing, and for a time it seemed to me that it was hypocritical for Canadians to want to be opposed to the cruise missile when we're so much linked with the United States in the defense setup in the first place. But I understand the difference is that the cruise missile was a first strike missile, and that to me makes quite a difference, although I'm opposed to all of it. Well, I guess the thing that concerns me is that I want to have some integrity in what I'm saying, too, and I can't be sort of under the umbrella of the U.S. in defense, whatever that means, and be opposed to some particular nuclear weapon at the same time. But that would be somewhat consistent with what I think.
What is our role as Christians? There are many Christians that span the whole gamut of reactions on in what way we should discipline ourselves as disciples in this age. Anything from thinking of the nuclear weapons as a deterrent, and the best way to be a peacemaker is to make sure you have those strong deterrents, to the other extreme of calling anything to do with bombs idolatry and sinful. And most of us are somewhere in between that rather big gap, and maybe even wider than I just explained it. Where are you individually, or if you don't know, what are you struggling with so that we might struggle with you this evening?
Well, I guess I'm struggling with the thought that I can't see that Christian discipleship in the nuclear age, I can't see that Christian discipleship should be anything different in the nuclear age, as it is, out with the nuclear age. only difference I can see is that perhaps the nuclear age is bringing it home to us by way of fear that there's something to be wrestled with. There's Christian discipleship and following Christ, to me, would be anti-all war. And how can you love your enemies when you have war? How can you love your enemies and make bombs a fine tributary if one accepts to love your enemies?
Yes. I think that's a great point. And one that I think we as Christians forget, that as we're putting an awful lot of energy in the anti-nuclear area, we're at the same time allowing thousands and thousands of people being killed, you know, in conventional war. And it almost seems like the devil, you know, is sitting back and laughing, because now he has us convinced that, you know, there's only one evil in the world, and while he continues to kill people with conventional weapons, and, you know, there's very little outcry against, you know, war here or war there, or, you know, we accept those statistics, and there's very few demonstrations against war in general, but, you know, it's all against nuclear, which hasn't been used since 1945. Granted, if it is, it's devastating, but still, in the last almost 40 years now, you know, it hasn't been used, and yet conventional weapons, you know, continue to be used.
Up here and then over here?
I think there's large demonstrations against war in general. El Salvador rallies all over the country, in various parts of the world. There are protests for war. I just think that the nuclear arms race is the focus for many people, because probably the next major war will be a nuclear war. And I think most people who are opposed to nuclear war are opposed to any kind of war that goes on today. I may be wrong on that, but I don't think it's fair to say that those who are opposed to the nuclear arms race are in favor of conventional war today.
I guess maybe that's where I'm a different. It seems to me that I'm not opposed to all wars per se. I'm not a pacifist totally, and that's where I have the problem. You know, I want to be somewhat consistent, but I'm not opposed, for example, to the Salvadorian peasants taking up arms against institutionalized violence. And yet I am opposed to any form of nuclear war. I guess it's just a gut feeling that I had, that there's something basically different about nuclear war compared with anything in the past. And secondly, I guess I'd be opposed to most wars, but not all, and that's where the tension comes within me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the whole question is, the way we pose it is so crazy in a way, because all of a sudden, we only talk about symptoms, but the weapon is merely a symptom of a deeper problem. And when people rally against nuclear war, it's a realization that, wait a minute, maybe for once, I might be involved. I don't want to be involved. Just let me sit around the fire with my Bible and read about how to be a Christian. But please, this is real involvement. So let's not. And the symptom is the weapon, but the problem is who's holding that weapon and why are they holding it. It's a great eye-opener to travel abroad and realize that there's so many people around the world distrust us as much as they distrust the Russians. They see us coming in a different sort of way, and exploiting and taking the minerals. The law of the sea conference and Reagan's totally wiped out the third world in a way, and that type of thing. But I think that the problem we have to deal with is, how are we going to build bridges to the third world? How are we going to build bridges to the Russians? How are we going to make them dependent on us? How are we going to be dependent on them so that the symptom goes away? And it's incredible that we have nuclear war rallies without dealing with the deeper questions.
Okay, in one sense, symptoms, what are they? In another sense, I'm hearing a real distinction between conventional war and nuclear war, or whether or not there should be that distinction. Shell, in his book, what's the title of that book?
Fate of the Earth.
Yeah, The Fate of the Earth, talks about the first death and the second death. That conventional war deals with first death, that I will die, but our generations will constantly recreate themselves. In the advent of a nuclear war, it's a greater evil, he says, because it's a second death that will wipe out life for all time, or at least the life as we know it for all time, and it will be a permanent death, not a regenerating death life type of thing. If that's different for some people, as you know, you can be a nuclear pacifist rather than a straight pacifist. I don't know. More comments. Up here.
Well, my idea on the conventional war and the nuclear war, I think in the general opinion, they believe a conventional war could be won, but a nuclear war, no one would win, so everyone would die.
But if, by that reasoning, if by chance we could win a nuclear war, then it could be justified, that the winning is the justifiable ness of war?
I think that's the public opinion, anyway.
What's yours?
I don't think anything on a mass scale is like a nuclear war to justify for any purpose.
Yes, back here.
Well, just a word to supplement what this gentleman said here, which I certainly agree with. It seems to me that nuclear narrows it too much. I wouldn't be surprised that if we all knew the facts that both Russia and the United States had other weapons, such as laser weapons or even germ warfare weapons, that go way beyond any nuclear problem. Now, so I think it's sort of ridiculous to just talk about nuclear. And in terms of killing people, goodness gracious, there are more people killed by automobiles than there are in these weapons.
So I'm an automobile pacifist?
Well, I agree with what this gentleman said. It seems to me the emphasis ought to be on what do we do to get rid of war. Now, maybe that's another good thing. But I think the nuclear is too small a target.
You know, also, I guess personally, I would hope that the church, again, could speak to all of us. And, you know, in a sense, make up its mind. If pacifism is the only way of Christianity, well, then tell me so that I can either be condemned or converted. But, you know, don't jump on the bandwagon, you know, this time when it's popular, you know, and then, you know, go back and forth. I guess I would, you know, hope that the church could somehow make a clear statement on, you know, is it possible for a Christian to be a soldier? You know, Luther wrote about it, and I think he said some pretty good things, or following the temporal authority. And I think that some of what he said is still very pertinent today, and yet the church, I think, has now forgotten that. I don't know, I guess I would like to be converted to pacifism if that's the only option that we have, but I guess I still see that there maybe are, you know, two options. And then, as a layman, I would hope that the church could address that and not just condemn one side and not say anything about the other side.
But there's not just two options.
Pardon?
There's not just two options. There's more than two options. And that's where everybody likes to sit, saying, well, I want to be one, I don't want to be the other. And that's the problem. You know, well, I don't want to be a pacifist, well, I don't want to be pro-nuclear. And that's a very nice cop-out for most people. But the real issue is, do you want to get in and do something? And to do something, you have to accept reality. And reality is, you're always going to have a Falkland Island situation. you're always going to have some type of Nicaraguan situation, something that's going to crop up that you're going to have to fight, Christian or not. So why not accept the fact that you're going to have this as a part of mankind and deal with the issue as a Christian, as a diplomat?
What is it that we can do? I've heard Christian discipleship to add in a nuclear age makes no difference. For some, it might make a difference. What is our role as Christians in today's world when we think about the whole possibility of war? And I wish the church would tell us, whether you're lay or ordained, we are the church here, and I want each of us to tell us what you think we, the church, should be about. Yeah.
I have no difficulty with anybody who wants to be completely pacifist. I think that certainly is fine. I haven't come to that conclusion myself, but I have come to the conclusion there are certain criteria for what I would call a just war, and almost no wars meet those criteria, but some do. And two of the criteria that I think have to be kept in mind are, first of all, have all other alternatives been tried and found wanting? That's one. And secondly, is there some measure of discrimination so that you're not wiping out whole populations as opposed to just fighting the so-called troops from the other side? Those are two of many criteria that have been used by the church over the years to say this is or this is not a just war. And I think in the sense of nuclear war as opposed to anything else in the past, it doesn't at least meet that second criterion. It isn't discriminating enough. You've got to wipe out whole populations as soon as you pull the trigger.
Well, and trying to decide what the church, lay or pastoral or whatever, says about this, we've heard, well, Luther said a few good things, and we're drawing from all sorts of sources, but isn't the one source we're supposed to draw from to decide what a Christian should do in this age or any other the example of Christ? And I can't see that the example of Christ leaves us too many alternatives.
The alternative.
I've been raised. I must say, I suppose it's only right to state one's total prejudice, and just when you make a statement like that, I have been a pacifist and come from three generations of pacifists. So that's my where that comes from. But I don't see the alternatives of whether they're practical, whether they're sense or nonsense, whether they're successful or unsuccessful. I don't see I've got an alternative.
Well, again, according to Luther, though, that he says that when John the Baptist and Christ talked to various people that came to him, the centurion and so forth, that he didn't condemn the fact that they were soldiers. He told them, to be good soldiers, not to complain about their pay, not to take advantage of
and to do harm to no man.
Well,
what kind of soldier is he going to make if he does that?
But also that there were situations, I think, where you could say that I'm not doing harm to, or again, being selective to where I'm solving a larger problem by taking care of the smaller one.
To do harm to no man.
Mm-hmm. Over here.
Yeah, and I think Warner, you hit on a point there that does relate directly in terms of if we are to live a life that is Christ-like or that emulates that lifestyle, it has to do with the people, the individual people. That's the level on which his ministry was based. And last week when we talked about this, a pastor, I think, was agonizing over the fact that he had in his congregation people who were literally responsible for pushing the button. And his response to that was, I don't know how to minister to that person. But that's the question. How do you minister to the people? Because when you go beyond the individual people that you have to deal with, you do get into questions of, can I do this, can I do that, where do I come down? And it seems to me that he did. He came down with the centurion at his place. He came down to him as an individual. And whatever he said to that person, it seems to me that the kind of ministry that we offer to people is the ministry that allows them to be themselves and also allows them to be to other people, which I would hope, although it's not for me to decide, I would hope it would allow them to walk away from the point of having to pull the trigger. to be able to say, I'm not going to be in that position because that gives me a decision about other people that I can't make. But if I'm going to minister to other people and my responsibility is to push that button someday, then maybe I'll have to walk away from that. But whatever their decision, our responsibility as Christians, I think, is to minister to them individually and to love them.
I think it's really a strong point to make that we must deal with people as individuals and that life is sacred to each person. I was at an international conference of public television in April, and I watched the film that was shot, that was released, that was taken after Hiroshima. And then there was a Swedish film that had interviewed some of the men that had actually been on the flight. We went from that to a film on government psychological torture of prisoners in Greece. We went from that to child prostitution in Manila. And all that I came out from with the day was just wiped out thinking, they're all, nameless faces. That's what people regard them. That's why people can treat them that way and not think of it. And that the only way that we can deal with that as Christians is thinking that this is an individual person that Christ loves. And I think, and it is my job as a Christian to love that person. Otherwise, it's very difficult to deal with all the horrors of the world that come at you aside from the war.
That's what I think a lot of people feel. There's a balance that comes into view here, where you may perceive a moral duty to perhaps have to go as far as killing a single person to perhaps help another. And I think that the problem with nuclear weapons, they add an entire new specter to this. I think you pointed this death one and death two. If you take an example, see a German guard guarding the gates of Dachau, I wouldn't hesitate 1 minute to kill him if I had to free the people that he is torturing himself. But when you throw a nuclear weapon into the picture, you not only kill the captor, you kill the victim as well. And I think that's where a lot of people have a real problem thinking about this, and I know I do. Because I'm not a cold pacifist. I think that I agree with the gentleman over here that perhaps a situation could arise where there could be a just cause to fight. And I think that although we did not use the Jews in Europe as an excuse in World War II, it does provide an example of a situation where violence, to me, is justified.
How can we be violent and be followers of Christ? How can we be violent in any way, and the worst violence would be to kill someone? How can we be violent in any way and say that we are followers of Christ?
You see, I perceive a moral duty there, right? I'm not going to label it as being Christian, being anti-Christian. I just have a deep set of moral feeling that if for instance, someone is holding a gun to someone else's head and is going to kill that person. What do? You stand by and let that person go ahead and kill the third person, or you kill the second person and say the third person's
what? What would Christ have done?
I frankly don't know.
I think that there's many types of violence. And the worst types of violence are violence of silence, violence of inaction, violence of talk. And it's we're not, to say that all of a sudden civilians are going to be involved is being naive. Civilians have always been involved. 10,000 Lebanese civilians have been killed in the last few weeks. That's involvement by civilians. To say that innocent people are going to be killed in a nuclear war is only to escalate the problem, escalate what has happened in every war since the beginning of time, that you can have civilians. So if you want to talk about violence, don't talk about active violence unless you're going to talk about the passive violence that is going on all the time. And that's why the question has got to be, let's not just ban nuclear weapons, let's do something to give everybody a stake in life. And there's many people in the world that have no stake in life. And we're not doing anything about it.
Thank you. That gets back to Neil's face situation, though. I really get disgusted when some people say, no, there weren't 10,000 Lebanese killed, there were only 5. Well, to me, one is too many. And I get back to the situation where I can, in a vacuum, see a situation arise where violence may be justified, me versus another person. But I always base that in the feeling that if that ever does arise, it's going to be because the third person is going to stand to retain his life, the innocent third person. And once again, I draw back the analogy of World War II, one fast with World War II. And I think a lot of older people, of course I wasn't alive then, I think a lot of older people are really troubled by that. Because I think that experience was at hand in their lifetime.
Okay. Over here and then back over to that.
I agree with a lot that you're saying, and yet it seems to me that to talk about the problem, the horror, the devastation that the Jews experienced from outside of that, and talk of that as a reason, and not to look at the experience and the times at which, when the Germans counted off every 10th person and simply killed them, and the people who were number 9, who took the place of number 10, that's active, that's not passive. And that's those people who were experiencing that. That's what a person can do.
The problem I have with that is that doesn't cure the problem. The person that pulled the trigger is still there to do it again. And I think...
But is the cure, is the cure...
Well, I guess what you're saying here is that perhaps there's no, to me, there is maybe no concrete answer. And I think you and I are getting awfully close to being in somewhat of an agreement. Some active participation needs to be involved by us. Where that comes into view, I don't know. I see maybe a greater duty in getting rid of the person who's going to do it again and again and again and again. Because I will not be there again if I take another person's place to see that it doesn't happen again the second, third, and fourth, and fifth time.
I'd like to help us to focus on the Christian discipleship, what you mean by that, which could be exactly what all of you are saying. I don't know if it would change anything. Warner here, then over here, and then here.
One comment. Earlier you asked about what the Christian community or Christian church can do. I think maybe we've lost sight of a mission of the Christian church, and that is to learn and help others to celebrate, even in the midst of tragedy and problems. That celebration doesn't mean that we have to be aloof to the fact that there is illness in the world and forget to cure those ills. But I think even as we're giving 100% of our energies to try to solve the problems that cause war, we also have another 100% effort in learning how to celebrate and helping others to celebrate in this world, because otherwise all we have is despair. And I don't think the church can survive or the world can survive in a world of despair. The rest of the world has enough to despair about. If the church joins that despair, well, then I think we're lost.
Okay.
The lady over here said, I don't think there are any alternatives. And I haven't come to quite that conclusion. I really think there are only two alternatives in my mind. One of them is pacifism. And I think that the biblical narrative leans strongly in that direction. Okay. But it doesn't say it clearly enough for me to say that there are no circumstances under which war is not justified. I think the second alternative then is to make darn sure in my own case what I mean by a just war. And I think that the criteria that the Christian Church in general have used over the years are really important. I think it would be good for every person in this group to say a part of Christian discipleship is to know what the Church has said about a just war, and to realize that almost no war in history falls into that category. The First World War certainly doesn't. The second is questionable on a number of counts, but at least it comes closer, okay, for some of the reasons that we're
I think World War II provides an example of a situation that could arise, is what I'm saying.
Okay. I think it's in my own mind, it's important for me to do that, and also to say that given a concrete situation, I've got to know how I would act. And there's no doubt in my mind that either in the circumstances this gentleman mentioned, or if somebody was attacking my wife, I would certainly use violence. I'm pretty sure of this, to make sure that no harm came to her. And if it meant killing that person to keep her from being killed, I would do it.
A great tape in the library here on the just war from our Lutheran tradition, although he's not Lutheran, but he can still speak it, I think, better than most of us.
He's also the four tapes of nonviolence.
Yeah. So you can listen to both if you want over here.
We heard, my husband and I went to hear John Mayer speak as part of the peace conference at PLU this spring. I couldn't understand the full concept of the just war either. And he said that, I don't remember exactly what he said, but the point is that a just war was fought with limits, and there was great respect for the religious perspective of what constituted a boundary around war. That, okay, if there was a need to defend or fight for some very valid reason, that there was no fighting on Sundays, there was no fighting on feast days, there was no fighting on all kinds of specific religious days, which invent then that there was very little fighting at all, and also that the fighting was restricted so that no one who wasn't declared a soldier would be involved in the fighting. And one of the points that he made is that now we are out of control in the way we approach war, the same way that a cancer cell is out of control. It has no limits to the way it divides. And when last summer in reading Matthew Fox's book on compassion, he gave a diagram of a ladder mentality with someone up and someone down. And he said, out of that power way of looking at life, which is very Western, very much American competition, comes strife, superiority, inferiority, strife, violence, and war. And that Christ was a circular person, that he, which is more a feminine concept according to Fox's book on compassion, that Christ came down from a position of power, took on the posture of a lowly person, said to his followers, you are my friends, not my slaves, and then enabled them to be powerful. And I don't think as a body of Christ, which we are, we literally embody his spirit, we can have other than a compassionate stance. And I think also that war is a symptom of not being at peace with myself, that I am my own enemy first, and that Chardin said, peace begins within the heart and extends to the ends of the universe. And I think the enemy is not out there. And that if I use violence or a weapon to fight, I'm acknowledging that my God has no power. Not that I don't take action as prayer, but prayer is not a substitute for action. And many battles have been won by prayer within our home, within our neighborhood, in my work. I do therapy, I have a lot of enemies who don't like me when I tell them the truth, that they have the power to be compassionate also. And to me, a Russian person is just another human being that carries, and that we cannot claim our power in war, or we aren't living as the body of Christ. That's my opinion.
I've been trying to answer the question, first of all, myself, what action should I take? And the two things I can do, I can do nothing. And just wring my hands in frustration to see the scope of the problem. Or I could do what the other extreme would be, maybe what Pastor John Nelson in Seattle was doing. He's the campus minister, Lutheran campus minister to the University of Washington. And he made a boat called the USS Plowshare that he bought for $200. And he's going to go out and try to enter the Bangor. And he's going to trespass on several properties that's already been, to try to block the passage. Simply symbolic. But he is going to get in with his 80-year-old mother and his uncle. And the penalty for trespass on federal property, especially where he's going to go, is 6 months in the federal penitentiary. He's already done time for his action. And but he's made a commitment to do that. And he's not going to be at peace with himself unless he does this. He's going to be a very unhappy person. That's the precedent. His family has always been that way, and it's carried down generation after generation, and it's ingrained in him. And I have a great deal of respect for him because he's put a lot on his line for his job, his family. I mean, that's a lot of commitment, and I have a lot of respect for that. The Lutheran Church, in light of that, he's asked him to acknowledge his actions. And in other words, can I get half pay while I'm in jail? Or something like that to keep my family going. And they have as much said, well, we agree with what you're doing, but we don't see that as your job. So he's not going to get support from the Lutheran Church for that action. And I don't know how he's going to respond to it in the future. But for me, I'm somewhere in between. I'm not ready to go to prison for 6 months, you know, leave my family out in the cold, and I'm not willing to sit here and do nothing. So I am trying to decide, you know, how many letters should I write, how many marches should I go to, you know, how many apples should I throw in the fence today? Hard question for the answer.
What should we be doing? Is the person who's asking for help. I will diddle it and want that same help. Back here, yes.
It seems that only terms of protest for stopping somebody else, but what about those people that work in the industry or that take money from the people that work in the industry when they know that they are doing that? Are they also part of the sinning? Why is it just protesting against doing it, but yet they take the benefits of the job or the spending of the money that somebody hands them that earned it at that job in working with an MX missile or whatever. If you really are a true believer, you would be willing to give up all those things. If you really believe what you say, not just be out protesting.
Nothing else.
And if the past is the same way. If you believe that way, you should forget the half pay. If you really believe what he's saying.
In his case, he is forgetting the half pay. He's going ahead.
But even the fact he asked shows that he was not all kind of honest in what he was doing.
He was pushing the church to come to a decision on where we as a church stands, mm-hmm. and it was one avenue for John to push us to make our statement clearer because it is ambiguous.
Think that was right.
Pardon?
I don't think that'd be right on his part to push the church at that point. I think that one of the things we can do is follow individual conviction, and I think that's maybe one of the problems, again, of the protest movement, is that it becomes a society of mutual bias, and it's easy for me to join those who feel like-minded, or if I'm encouraged to come into a group, whatever the reason is. But I think one of the things that, as a kind of Christian, is that I have to answer to my Lord, and I have to come to some conviction in my own life, and I'm not sure that I necessarily have to go public with that conviction. I mean, it might be that I go public with it, but it may not have to be like John Nelson that goes public in that way, sort of a calculated spontaneity. And to me, he would have been much more effective if he would have just done the protest afterwards. I would have said, thank God for a man who has a conviction. But to plan it out 6 months in advance, I guess it defeated the purpose for me.
Being part of a large contingency here from Minneapolis, I hadn't heard of John Nelson before I'd gotten here to hold him. But it does seem to strike me that perhaps he was calling the church to come. That maybe he was doing what he was doing not necessarily to just to get paid, half paid from the Lutheran Church, but to be able to say, make a stand. I'm going to make you say what you really believe,
mm-hmm.
and calculated or uncalculated.
And just a footnote on John Nelson there too, is that the half pay wasn't some new thing that he was concocting up. It was in campus ministry, there is a possibility of having a study leave after 7 years in one location, and he had fulfilled that, and that was what he was wondering, if this would qualify as study leave. I understand it right.
He didn't ask the Lutheran Church for that, but he asked the campus ministry to.
The National Lutheran Campus Ministry Board made that decision. Yeah. Let's not talk about the Lutheran Church.
Sure. Right. Okay. And we have Elmer, a regional director of campus ministry. Sorry, Elmer.
Is that I was at the meeting in which he asked, and which he was clear, and I just agreed with the decision. However, it's very fair to say his point was clearly made in the meeting. I am not asking for money. The money was important only in terms that it was the commitment of the church. He says, if it's $10, this is a quote from John at the meeting, if it's $10 or 7 cents, just so it's a commitment of the church to the past. So he wasn't at that meeting at all pleading for money, and I think that would be fair. It would not be nationally known because you weren't at the meeting, but that would be fair to say.
Over here.
It does point out the difficult paradox that of all the things that I've read about the recent pacifist movement both here and in Europe, what seems to be happening is that people are joining, as was said, because they feel like they're going to be personally involved, and it's growing enormously, and it is becoming successful to some degree, at least in terms of numbers. And there is a difficult paradox in terms of, I don't know, what we seem to be called to be is faithful, not successful. And that success isn't the criterion by which we need to judge things, I don't think. I mean, we're getting then into competition because the peace movement is getting larger now. People are joining it who wouldn't necessarily join it before because they weren't total pacifists, and now the movement's saying, okay, you don't have to be a total pacifist, just come join us, let's get bigger, let's have large demonstrations. In terms of making a point, I mean, there's always the side that says somebody might be moved, there might be a point at which groundswell happens, and yet in terms of making personal commitments, our goal isn't success, I don't think. I don't think it's a matter of making things happen the way we want them to happen, because if faithfulness is faithfulness and God is God, then that's taken care of, and it's our faithfulness that counts.
But what does it mean to be faithful? Should I buy a $200 boat? Is that faithful? Is the faithful do nothing? Or is there things in between that the rest of you are doing, or things beyond either side that the rest of you are doing, or are thinking maybe you're struggling, if maybe you should do, to help me and others who are trying to struggle with this?
I think faithfulness has been mentioned by lots of different people in lots of different ways, that our response individually is how we are faithful. And it's our response to God. God loves and we respond. And what our faithfulness is has to do with us and not to do with whether our movement is successful or even whether the people who are going to keep on doing the killing kill us and we're not around to stop them anymore. It's not, I don't know that that's part of our faithfulness if that's the way we want to respond to it.
I think if you want something concrete to do, and even as Christians, is to tell people who it'll make a difference, listen, we're all scared as hell. And you've raised the level of rhetoric to such a point that it's gone beyond what seems to be needed at this point. And join the movement, so to speak, and let Reagan know that, you know, what in the world are you doing? I don't see the level of threat from the Russians at this time giving us the need to build a 700 ship navy or some other tremendous buildup. But I think we should let them know that it is scaring everybody to death. And not only that, but what are you doing to lower this tremendous amount of tension that's been built up around the world?
Can any of you who have been silent. I'm just wondering, what are you thinking? Can you at all verbalize that? I'm just, if you can, please do so. The rest of you who have not been silent, let's continue talking. Yes, back
there. Well, there is a question in my mind as to the motivation of, say, the anti-nuclear movement. If we think of Christ's actions, I don't think Christ ever acted in terms of fear. He acted in terms of belief. And I think in this movement there is a great motivation of fear. And you say, really, what are we doing to spread the teachings of Christ? And as I recall, or at least my reading, Christ did not put that forward in terms of fear, but in terms of belief.
Well said. I'm still fearful.
Can I say something?
Yes.
It's hard for me to speak about this, but I will. We talked before about what Jesus would do, but I try to do my best. I was in World War II, and I fought, and I shot, and I killed. It's hard for me to speak of this, but I lost over there, and I lost part of my body over there, and part of my blood, fighting for this country. And ever since that time, it's in the back of my mind, will God forgive me for doing these things? I've done it. And so it's hard for me to realize, and I keep talking to God and asking, I know He has forgiven me. And I say, what will I do when I see Jesus someday? He'll say, you shot, you killed, you fought in the war. It's against my principles. But I say, I feel in my heart that He will say, Don, you're forgiven. You did what you had to do. And you kept this country, this whole world, a strong Christian nation. You helped defeat a man who burned Bibles. You helped defeat a man who would condemn religion and all Christianity. And because of what you fought for and did, we have a strong Christian world today. That's what I feel. Hard for me to talk about.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Up here and then over here.
I think on the issue of fighting, and like this man was saying, that when you go and fight, it applies to the commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor more than thyself, for the idea. And you will go to fight to protect your neighbor because you love your neighbor more than yourself, or as thyself. That's what I think about.
Okay. Here, and then here, and then there.
I wanted to just clarify.
Okay.
Something there, that when Jesus talked about neighbor, I think it's important that He meant everybody. Mm-hmm. That He really left to that word in the new definition. He wasn't talking about you.
The man next door.
Yeah.
Okay. When you ask about what do you think, what are the rest of us thinking, perhaps many of us are not knowing what we're thinking. We're trying to become a little more informed. I do a little reading, or I listen to many of you as you formulated your own opinions, and I'm not sure where I stand really right now. I think that one thing that helped me just within the last few weeks at district convention, Ben Arsdal spoke of our call to be perfect. And yet, because we are not perfect, we are also called to compromise. And we compromise in so many things daily, in so many, many, many ways. And yet then we are called to compassion. For me, that spoke very personally on a lot of things that I have to deal with. And maybe this is one of these other things. When this gentleman talks about his experiences in the war, I just know that God has compassion on his dilemma that he has been in. And I don't see God as saying, how come? I just see Him welcoming him into His arms. But the conflict in that.
we have about 5 or 6 more minutes. I'm going to tell you, because there is that concert at 10. No matter roughly where we are, we'll be having to break it then, so just let you know that will be coming. Tom?
Yeah, this gets back to love your neighbor as yourself. I'm not aware that golden rule is the basis of the New Testament. It seems to be a rational thing to do. I would like to be treated as I treat others, but it seemed like what the New Testament was saying was not just love your neighbor as yourself, but love as God has loved you. And we have to think about what that means for us. And this gentleman down here was saying it a little bit about how he feels that God will accept him and does accept him, and we are called to accept others, including the people that burn Bibles, including the communists, and we have to ask, how are we to love? And I think we are to love as the one who rules over us.
Yes.
It's been interesting listening tonight. I attend Stanford University, and down there, a lot of speakers coming through both sides, and I struggle constantly to feel where do I stand. And this tonight, there's different sides of the fourth. I also feel, where am I going? But I really think it's very important for all of us to sit back and realize that we are not called to judge. We're called to call forth and make people aware. The pastor is a very valid response. The man who bought the boat is another valid response. It's very important for us to look inside ourselves, as many people have said, and to really fight for what we believe in. The man that shot was killing out of love. I mean, that's hard to accept maybe, but if he believed that and believed in Christ, then that is what his only response was. If you believe that you are a pastor, that is your only response. But it's not for us to look at someone else and say, well, you know, this is what I'm doing, I think you should probably do this as well. And I think it's very important for all of us to look at ourselves, to make other people aware of what we believe in and why we believe it. But then that's when you decide.
That's why I said I don't think I have any alternative. I didn't say I don't think you have any alternative. I said I don't think I have any other alternative. And I really subscribe wholeheartedly to everything.
I think it's Kohlberg that wrote out the stages of moral development. And as I recall, the stages between 4 and 5 have something to do with black, white, right, wrong, good, evil thinking. But the highest level of moral development has to do with universality. My enemy is also the one I'm to love. And I think that has a lot to do with the position we take in looking at how to approach nuclear war. And I think Christ calls us to ultimate maturity.
This is kind of interesting. One premise that I think is probably shared by everybody in this room is that everybody in this room, I would say, to a person is against nuclear weapons. I may be wrong, but I think we all have fear of them. And we would all just as soon see them not even be in existence. But they are there, and our reactions have been kind of interesting tonight, because we haven't had discussion tonight tended to go towards war in general. I think that the onus of the power of destruction of these things is just so tremendous that perhaps we don't even want to discuss them in particular. And I it's also interesting, another point that never came out is I as a Christian, I think I see the other issue that nobody talked about, and that is Christian stewardship of the earth. And that's the thing that really troubles me about nuclear weapons. I guess back to what I was saying before, I can see, for me, a situation where violence on my behalf may be justified. But when something is so awesomely destructive that will probably serve to extinguish everything on earth except cockroaches. I honestly could never go that far myself and cause something like that apparently to be put in actual use. And I pity, I really do pity the person who has to make that decision if and when it ever comes out.
Yeah.
Sure. A recommendation. I come across a magazine that some of you may be familiar with called Sojourners. I hear it. Mm-hmm. I don't know that meant everybody, but it's one that I have really benefited from. It has definitely an anti-war approach and possibly could be called pastors or whatever, but it's a beautifully written magazine. I'd recommend it strongly.
Two things that are in the bookstore. One is a collection of articles from Sojourners called A Matter of Faith, which I think is in the bookstore. Then also Dan Erlander from Holden here has put together a little book, By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb, which are two resources. There's lots of others there and other places too that you can look at. But I think that the gentleman who said that we act in fear or belief was a nice thing for me to think about. How am I acting? And let's go on our way and go out in good courage and listen to some good music and then continue the conversation throughout the week.